I was raised by a mother who was half Italian, half German, and a father who was English. I knew right from little that I wanted what my grandparents had. I wanted what my parents had. I wanted to be a wife and a mother above anything else. When I met Ross, it was like, oh my God, this person wants what I want. Whatever life threw at us, we were going to handle it. It was fine. We'll have no money and we'll have lots of kids and it'll be fantastic. And it's that solid root of it's going to be all right. It's going to be all right that stays playing in your mind even when stuff starts to turn.
Talk to me about those red flags. What starts to worry you?
Friday would come and Ross would disappear. I didn't understand it. I was like, why are you starting a row with me? We haven't, like, we've been fine. The paranoia, the pressure, the stress, I don't know what was building, just got more and more and more intense. I would be upset and I would pray and I would say, why? I don't deserve this.
Hey guys, just wanted to pop in and say thank you for those who have already subscribed to the channel. And for those of you that haven't, or maybe you don't know that you haven't, please think about doing so. Because the bigger that the channel grows, the more content that we can make to bring to you guys. And I know from all the DMs and emails and messages that I get that you guys really love this kind of content. The educational stuff that we put out is helping so many people. So please think about subscribing so we continue to make more content. Hey guys, and welcome back to Tea with the Queen. Today's conversation is a very special one. A few weeks ago, many of you heard me speak with Ross about his journey from being a professional golfer to almost losing it all to alcohol abuse and then recovery. But today I wanted to give space to the story that is so often left untold. The story of the partner who lived alongside it. I'm joined by Becky, who before she was ever the wife, was a woman who had already faced extraordinary challenges in her own life. Shortly after Becky and Ross first met, she was diagnosed with having cancer, a time that shaped her strength, resilience and perspective long before alcohol abuse entered her marriage. Today, we're talking honestly about what it's like to love someone in addiction, to raise four children in the middle of that reality and to find the courage to choose boundaries even when it feels impossible. Becky, thank you so much for being here and joining me today.
What an intro.
So following Ross's video, we have had so much interest, so many questions of people who are in the same position as Ross, but even more so women who are in your position, hence the reason I wanted to talk to you about this today. So thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
Before we get into it, tell me a little bit about Becky before Ross.
Okay, so Becky before Ross probably can't be really explained without digging up a little bit of family.
Okay.
So I'm very strong rooted in family and what that meant.
Yeah.
So at 17, before I met Ross, I was raised by a mother who was half Italian, half German, and a father who was English. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of those international roots, I think you'd say, I think played a huge part in how I was raised. Yeah. And who I was before Ross. I was fiery, crazy. I had three siblings, two sisters and one brother. And we were always outdoors. We just lived in mud. And we just loved like walks and yeah, we're just little wild things.
Yeah.
But I think who I really was before Ross was somebody who knew exactly what she wanted. I knew right from little that I wanted what my grandparents had. I wanted what my parents had. I wanted to be a wife and a mother above anything else. So that just shaped every decision I made. So when I went to go and do hairdressing before I got sick, yeah, which you guys all know.
Yeah.
Before I got sick, I went and did hairdressing, but I only chose that course because I knew that when I had children, it would be the easiest thing to maneuver around, yeah, my life.
Yeah.
So all my decisions, even before meeting Ross, were based on being a mother, being a wife, and trying to find somebody that could connect with me, that wanted, yeah, that same thing I wanted.
So tradition was so important to you.
So important. I think being Italian and having those strong roots of family and togetherness, and you just didn't quit. And I think that really was something that I aspired to be like yeah, my grandparents. Mm. They had a business that they ran together and it was just it was everything I wanted. So when I met Ross just before I was 18, and he had exactly the same core values as me, it was like, oh my God, this person wants what I want, because no person at 17 knows that they want to be a wife.
I was just going to say, that's so
rare. A mother,
rare.
It's so young, especially in boys. So like when I knew that that's what I wanted, no other guy that I knew wanted that. They were like, well, not, no. Way too soon. So when I met Ross and he was exactly on the same wavelength that I was, it was an instant connection of what you wanted at your absolute core.
So how old were you when you and Ross got together?
17. So it was just before I turned 18.
Yeah.
And
you're working hairdressing?
Yeah, I was hairdressing at the time. I was doing an apprenticeship for £2.50 an hour, I will say. Ian, if you're watching. But yeah, £2.50 an hour apprenticeship. And I loved it because I knew that that was going to allow me to have children and do a career at the same time. Yeah. So I was never wanted to just be a mum and just be a wife. I always wanted to have my own thing kind of running alongside those things, but they were the absolute pinnacle of what I wanted and who I wanted to be was those two things.
And then you meet Ross, and of course we've got to touch on it, but tell me then, because you get really ill.
Yeah, so I came to Ross and I said, look, I'm sick. You didn't sign up for having a sick partner. Like if you want to go, you can go. We were only really like courting for a few months prior to diagnosis. So when I presented that to him, he didn't even waver. He didn't even flinch. It was like I just told him nothing. Mm. He was like, well, no, like, what about? Like, we'll be fine. Like, which is just something we're going to do now.
Yeah.
He was always so like upbeat about absolutely anything you had to face. He was just like, well, no, this is what's happening. I'm going to be here with you and we're going to beat it. Mm. There was never a case of, oh, what if Becky died? Like that didn't come into it at all. It was just, okay, now we got to get you better.
How did it change your plan though? Because you are a determined young lady up until this point. You want to be a wife, you want to be a mother. Yeah. And then all of a sudden you get this horrendous news.
I think the scariest thing was being told you couldn't have children potentially. Mm. You could potentially not have children and you'd have to go through this invasive treatment. And because it was so advanced, it was a case of we can't freeze your eggs.
Yeah.
So you haven't got a time limit on this now. You've got to go straight in for your treatment. And that I think was the scariest thing. But for Ross was such a rock, I can't explain it. So when it came up that you couldn't freeze eggs and I had to go for treatment straight away, I was like, what if there's a chance we can't have children? It doesn't even come into it. He's just like, no, just absolute point blank refusal that would even be an option. Mm. It's just like, no, we're going to, it's fine. So that conviction makes you convinced that you're going to be fine. So he's like, no, it doesn't even come into it. Like, it's not a question. They're not going to freeze your eggs, but we are going to have children. And I just believed him with absolutely every fibre of my being.
And was this going against the doctor's advice at the time?
No, not at all. So they couldn't freeze eggs. That was just, I didn't have time. I had to go straight into the treatment because it had spread so far. Mm. So against their advice would probably been like, no, freeze my eggs and I'll risk.
No, I mean, sorry, that were the doctors at that time saying, you know, the chances of you having children are 0.5%.
So no, not at all.
What? Oh, okay. Yeah. So
they couldn't know.
They didn't know.
They couldn't know for certain. Everybody is so different, but there's a possibility.
Yeah.
So the possibility is there that you might not be able to. Mm. So my German part of my brain kicks in and is like, right, okay, but there is now this possibility that we can't. So maybe we have to structure this a different way. And he's just absolutely not. He just point blank refuses to believe anything that he doesn't believe at his core.
Yeah.
So he's like, no, it's going to happen.
And how long does that period go on for? Is it 6 months? Is it a year?
Yeah. So the treatment itself lasts a year.
Yeah.
It gets delayed along the way. Sometimes if your white blood cell count is too low, so you can't have chemotherapy. Mm. If your blood cell count has to be at a certain point for you to be able to have the chemo, otherwise they push back your treatment and it can be delayed sometimes for hours or days.
Yeah.
And that just kept getting delayed. And then you have to do things that you can't work because you can't be around people. So if you have a cold, I get pneumonia. If
right, yeah,
it's that. So you have to almost put yourself in this bubble, which my grandma wanted to put me in.
But
at 18, you don't really go, you don't go willingly into a bubble.
Yeah.
So we definitely did a lot of things that maybe we shouldn't have done. So like still going out, still drinking, still being 18.
Mm.
We had a lot of focus that year. So there was a lot of, it sounds doomy gloomy to have chemotherapy for a year, but at 18, you're so much more resilient.
Yeah.
You're so much more resilient. You still just do things no matter what, because you're not going to be told at 18.
And you're indestructible at 18.
Oh, totally. You're bomb-proof. Mm. Absolutely bomb-proof.
Yeah.
So everyone's going, all the older women in my family are going, oh my gosh, you can't eat steak. Why are you eating raw steak? You can't do this. You can't do that. And the limitations of fear-led limitations that were trying to be put on to us at the time at 18, you just blow straight past.
Were you afraid though?
No.
Really?
Yeah, I really wasn't. It sounds crazy to say I wasn't afraid, but I think I was so thankful. I think thankful was the best word to describe it. I had three younger siblings, and as the oldest, there's a different level of responsibility on your head. So when I looked at them, I used to just thank God it was me. Thank God it was me, because I knew I was strong enough. I knew I was stoic enough to survive it, to not let it break me. And it takes it away from them to say that they wouldn't have been in that situation as well, but I would have hated to watch it.
Mm.
I don't think I could have watched them go through it. I was so glad I was the one going through it.
And dealing with it.
Yeah.
As opposed to...
I didn't want anyone to feel sorry for me. Mm. I was fundraising. We ended up doing a big charity event for Teenage Cancer Trust, and me and Ross got to meet the entire Arsenal football team.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. My poster was all over the town, like Becky with a shaved head, like on every window in Argos. we made it really, really fun. And it sounds weird to say you don't regret, like you don't feel anything from having it, but I don't. I feel like it was actually a really cool year for me and Ross, and it bonded us together so intensely.
So tell me about the day you get the news that you've got the all clear.
Yeah, that was great. That was great. No more chemotherapy. It was fantastic. So the chemo, it was fine at the start. It started to get really difficult towards the end. I didn't know what it was at the time, but now I'm older looking back, I know that a lot of it was anxiety. So I'd be going down to have chemotherapy. So in between the treatments, we made it so much fun and we didn't act like anything was happening.
Yeah.
But when the treatment was happening, there was moments where you'd walk down the hall and there was this big green chair that you had to sit in. And I didn't know at the time, but I was attaching a lot of anxiety to that chair, which is a weird thing to be afraid of.
I get
that
it, though.
You're in this chair for 8 to 9 hours a time, being pumped full of everything under the sun. So on the way down to the chair, Ross would be parking the car and my mum would be walking with me, holding my hand, and I'd be dry retching all the way down the hallway. And it was just anxiety. Because nothing was wrong with me. Between treatments, I was sick for maybe 2 or 3 days.
Wow.
I'd stopped taking anti-sickness meds because they made you mildly sick for like 2 weeks. So I chose to be intensely sick for two to three days. And then I was fine. And then I could live.
Yeah.
And then I was back in that corridor and it was like, oh God, here we go again. So I didn't know what I was feeling at the time. Yeah. Now I'm older, I know that that's anxiety, but back then we didn't have words to attach to these things.
Yeah. And that makes sense.
Yeah.
So you get the news, you've got the all clear,
happy
days. And of course, then what happens?
Noah.
God love him.
Oh, Noah, 10 fingers, 10 toes, like you said, just absolutely beautiful. He's almost 6 foot now and wants to be a psychologist. Yeah. So he's on his way into the world.
Look at that.
And it's fantastic.
But not without some worries. Just for those that maybe didn't see Ross's podcast, there was a little bit of a scare.
There was,
because you found out you were pregnant, having just had treatment.
Yeah, so I'd finished the treatment and then you have to have this scan to make sure that all the cancer's gone from your body. So they inject you with this kind of, it's like, I don't know the correct word. It's like radioactive fluid. That's what I'm just going to call it. It sounds like something out of Marvel. But they inject you with this stuff and it highlights any tumours in your body or any grist or anything that's not normal. And you cannot have this if you're pregnant. So they asked me so many times. They're like, are you pregnant? Are you pregnant? I was like, no, I'm not pregnant. I don't even have cycles at the minute. Everything stops with chemotherapy.
Of course, yeah.
No cycles, no hair, no... all of it. You go back to, it's almost like a giant baby body. Like a giant baby. And so everything stops. So you don't know. So of course you don't think you're pregnant. Like that's just crazy. No is the answer. But they asked me so many times, it made me feel so uncomfortable. So I said to Ross, I'm just going to do the test. And then I can be like, I did a test. So you can stop asking me.
Yeah.
And then I did a test after they'd done it because question kept looming. I was like, they asked so many times. I just want to know for absolute certain so that when they call me, I can say, like, I did a test and it was a no. And it was a yes. And I did 26 other tests.
Did you really?
I just couldn't believe it. I could not believe it.
Oh my goodness.
Still bold, still recovering.
Yeah.
And yeah. And now this baby. I was like, what?
What did the doctor say?
So we called them and said, I'm really sorry. It turns out I was pregnant. I didn't know. So they then went through a whole series of things that could be potentially wrong with the baby. It could be born with mutated limbs, limbs not missing it, like at all. There could be problems with the fetus from that scan. And they advised that in this instance, so obviously they're not going to just throw it out there for every instance, but for this particular instance that they would advise termination. So that was a conversation that I had with Ross. And I said, look, what if this baby's born with one arm? I mean, it seems so trivial now to say, like as an adult now at 30, almost 36, a baby being born with one arm is not the end of the world.
Yeah.
Like, you can cope. Yeah. But at 19, you're like, what if this baby's missing things, like what if something's wrong with them?
And it goes back to you
so
saying
scary.
About your siblings. You didn't want them to be sick.
No.
You wanted to be sick.
Yeah.
So you could potentially have a baby that's sick and you don't want that
I don't want that for a baby. But it doesn't mean that if I found out that the baby had one arm, like we'd just have baby with one arm. But Ross was so, again, exactly how he was when he found out. Well, no. This baby's born with one arm, it's going to be the best bowler you've ever seen.
Always positive.
So always so positive that then it just totally convinces you, I can do it. Like, I'll be fine.
Yeah.
We'll do this. And so we did it.
Yeah.
So we have this baby and I've got photos and my hair is still maybe this long. It's only just growing back by the time I have Noah.
How was the pregnancy for you, having just gone through all of that chemo? Your body would have been weak, was it not? Or
it probably was, but at 18, 19, I had 19 when I had him, 18 pregnant, you do not feel it.
True.
You just don't. Like I say earlier, you're bomb-proof. You are totally built for warfare at that age.
Yeah.
Like, you can withstand so much.
Yeah.
So you don't even think about it. It's not a case of, are you tired? Because at 18, you're just up.
Yeah.
And I was not really a tired kid anyway. I was very much a baby mum. I used to drive my mum nuts when I was really, really small. I was always wanting to do stuff, always crying or like just, she struggled.
Yeah.
Sorry, mum. But I was very like high energy child.
Yeah.
So I think as a teenager, I still had all that energy. So it doesn't transfer. It stays.
Yeah.
It doesn't deplete just because you've been sick. If anything, it makes you more hungry for life because you could have just lost it.
Mm-hmm.
Even though you're not dwelling on it, you're living with that knowledge.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So Noah's born, absolutely fine, which is great. What does family life, which is what you've always wanted, what does it now start to look like?
It now starts to look crazy because we lived at my mum's. So we had my mum and dad, all my siblings still there. A couple of their partners were staying all the time as well. And Ross and myself, and baby Noah, who was then pretty much raised by 12 adults, not just us. Yeah. Mm. All our friends adored him, all the family. He became almost this thing of
wonder.
Of magic. Like, oh my gosh, we nearly lost our daughter and this is now her son. And he just got absolutely put on this little Noah pedestal of, you are marvelous because of what we nearly lost. Like, my mum had me very young. So when I was sick, my mum was only 36.
Wow.
She's the same age I am almost now. And if I had to think about what that meant for her at my age, if I had to watch that little boy get sick, my entire life would just... Oh, and then that kid had a baby. Oh, how could you be anything but absolutely absorbed in that child?
Yeah.
They just loved him. So he was being raised by a whole heap of us. It was not just me and Ross.
It was a miracle, though. Yeah. When you break it all down, it was an absolute miracle that he was born okay.
Yeah.
How long before baby number two comes along?
Noah was 2.5. So I actually didn't plan to have Eli. This was Ross. So Ross came to me and he said, are we going to have another baby? And I said, I think you're absolutely nuts. I'm really enjoying just having Noah. I love just having Noah. All our attention's on him at the minute. He's just 2. And he said, yeah, but I don't want a huge age gap. He said, like, going back, we knew we both wanted a big family. Yeah. We knew we wanted children. So he was like, if we end up having an age gap that's like 5-6 years between each, that's going to be quite a big age gap if we want to have quite a lot of children. Mm. And I was like, yeah, you're right. Okay, maybe we have another one then. So I wasn't totally on board when he suggested it, but we had a miscarriage and then that was it. I was totally on board. Mm. I think nothing wakes you up like losing a baby.
Yeah, absolutely. So,
you wake up and you go, okay, actually, no, I do want this, even at however old. How old was I? I was 21.
21 when you had Eli.
21 with Eli.
How did having children, how did that change the dynamic between you and Ross? Because already you guys have been together now 3 years.
Yeah.
You've been through so much.
Yeah.
The illness and now 2 boys.
Yeah.
How do you think, looking back and reflecting on that, has it changed the dynamic?
I don't think it really changed the dynamic between me and him. I think Ross always loved me. It's what kept me going for so many years through everything that then starts to come up around this sort of time when Eli's small.
Yeah.
And that love it's so difficult to explain. But when you're that connected that early on and you've gone through so many of life's trials that don't usually hit people until they're older, you're just so rooted to each other that you feel like you can withstand absolutely anything. Like I say, bombproof, just built for warfare. Mm. Whatever life threw at us, we were going to handle it. It was fine. Yeah, we have more babies. Yeah, okay, we're poor. Oh, you can start a PGA degree and go to university. Great. We'll do it all. We'll have no money and we'll have lots of kids and it'll be fantastic.
It'll all work out.
And it'll all work out. And it's that solid root of it's going to be all right. It's going to be all right that stays playing in your mind even when stuff starts to turn around Eli being born.
Are we doing the professional golf at this stage? Remind me when Eli's born.
Eli's born and he's started his PGA degree around this sort of time. So,
and at this point, are you noticing an issue with the alcohol or no? Is it all still very social?
Yes, it's still social, but it's starting to throw up some red flags in terms of you're going out and you recognise it. Actually, we'll go out and I can stop and he can't stop. And our friends will drink to the point where they're passing out. And he won't pass out. He can just keep going. So he's got this built-in tolerance to withstand so much alcohol that it was like, this is now not right. Like, there's something that's not right here. How are you drinking this much? I used to say it would have almost been better if he had been a person that passed out, because at least I could have then dragged a body into bed, rather than dealing with what was starting to evolve. And I think the PGA thing starting was the contingency plan. So it's not really what he wanted to do, but he knew that that's what he had to do for his family. Mm-hmm. We had these two little boys. Mm-hmm. So if the playing career didn't take off, the PGA degree was still solidly there the to support plan. His family, yeah. 100%. But he wasn't doing what he wanted to do, which was to play. Mm. He was doing something that was right for his family. Mm. And I think maybe that contributed, and probably having more babies at such a young age after, and not really processing maybe what had actually gone on, and just feeling like you were invincible.
Yeah.
And actually you're not. You're not invincible.
Talk to me about those red flags just after Eli's born.
Yes.
What starts to worry you?
I think it's the chase, I think, for staying a lad, staying one of the guys, going out and being one of your friends, like being with your mates, and not being able to detach from that and going straight into and being a full-time family man. I think that's hard at 22 to wrap your head around. So I think when these red flags start showing up with the more drinking and then coming home and starting rows, what seemed to be out of nowhere for no reason. I didn't understand it. I was like, why are you starting a row with me? We haven't, like, we've been fine. But it's the paranoia, the pressure, the stress. I don't know what was building until he would then have a drink and then it would come out. And then you'd be like, whoa, who is this? And that who is this just got more and more and more intense. Like, you couldn't tell who was Ross and who was not. It was really, really weird experience. But that's those red flags, is when you don't recognize them anymore. They're drinking and who are you? Mm. It's that.
And that bond that you had, you know, all through your illness, having the two boys, clearly incredibly close. Did you start to feel when he was under the influence that there was a distance there?
Hugely.
Yeah.
But there was a very clear divide between the two people. It was really weird to be able to, I think, mentally cope with it, because it was coming every Friday, Saturday, not really Sunday. Sunday was like the recovery day, like when you're tired and you're not really getting up. But he was never that person. Saturday and Sunday were like drinking days. So I ended up dreading those 2 days every single week. And I just had to make it through those 2 days until I got my husband back, because Friday would come and Ross would disappear. I didn't know what version you were getting, but you were not getting Ross. You didn't get the person that loved you, that would do anything for you. I used to tell him at the time, like, so on the Sundays when you'd kind of then go through everything that he'd done and said, because you're still carrying it, you have to say it. You can't just, how can you keep it in? You can't, if somebody's starting rows with you, and they have no idea what they're rowing about, they have no idea what they're saying, what it's causing. Sunday comes and you go on an event. You'll be like, oh, you said this. Answer yourself. Why did you say that?
Would he even remember?
No, sometimes not. And that was what made it really difficult, because he'd be apologising for something he had no idea he'd said or no idea he'd done. He had no idea. Mm. And it wasn't just me. He'd offend other people as well. So,
yeah.
I mean, I could rest easy that it wasn't directed at me. It was directed at anybody. Mm. And it would be random. So you wouldn't know. Like, and it's that flip of, oh my gosh, this isn't you. Then Sunday you're held accountable and you get the apology that feels strange, because they don't know what they've done. And so they're saying sorry, because they know what you're saying is the truth, but they don't know that they've done it. And you're like, you did this, and you're presenting all these facts, and then they're going, oh my gosh, I need to now ring everybody and say sorry for things I have no idea I said. I must be so weird.
Yeah. How does this, when this is going on, impact your parenting? Because you've still got two little boys now.
Yeah. That's a good question. I think, and I always try to separate the two things, but it bleeds into each other. You can't stop it.
It has to, yeah.
And especially when you're young and you're raising children through your 20s, your ability, I think, to rationalize is not so good. So if you're going to argue with me, I'm going to argue back. And the Italian's going to come out and you're going to get all of me. I'm going to fight fire with fire. And that is really not the way to do it. Fighting fire with fire just made things turn into an inferno. So if Ross would argue with me, I would argue with Ross. And at that age, it's really difficult. You think the children are asleep. They're asleep. They're in bed. They don't know. But they probably do. And ours definitely did. When they got older and we have these conversations about it, they knew. They didn't like it. But
so how long does it go on for? Because this is the first cycle.
Yeah.
How long does this go on for?
During these times, we get Ross for most of the week. And then we have the other version of Ross 2 days a week.
So every weekend?
Pretty much. Every weekend. Pretty much. Every weekend. Not every weekend, but most.
That, can I just say, also, you're a young family, just starting out. That also puts a massive pressure on you financially.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot of money being spent if we're out boozing, potentially.
Yeah. It's difficult because Ross is resourceful.
Yeah.
So a lot of it was bets. So you'd make a bet and then you'd get money and then the money would feed the addiction.
I see.
But the bets were the thing that would then keep it going. So yeah. It was a nightmare. He actually financially, he wasn't putting us under a lot of strain, which actually, I mean, it's not good because
it's impressive. Though.
It's impressive. Yeah. I was like, is that the right thing to say? It is. It's very impressive to shield your family financially from an addiction you know you have, so you find other means to get it, other means to I'll bet you this, I'll do this. If you can do that, I'll do that, and then stick some money on it.
Yeah.
Job's good. You're not hurting anybody, right? You're not costing my family money.
Yeah.
But you are, you're costing other things, but yeah, finances weren't ever really a strain in that sense when it came to the addiction. Finances were a strain in general, we were young. We have little babies, but in terms of the addiction, he never let that bleed into the money. It was always, I'll do X, Y, Z to get it. And that's how it just stayed.
In that first cycle, do you have a memory of one of the worst weekends? Or were they all pretty tough?
I think what was most difficult was to try and break through to him on these weekends because they were all just not enjoyable. You wouldn't want to go through them. Yeah. Like anybody that's struggling with somebody that has an addiction, you wouldn't want to repeat those days. Some days were worse than others, some days weren't, but it doesn't matter because you were already building yourself up for the worst. So the worst may as well have happened. You may as well have dealt with the worst weekend every weekend. Because what's going on internally is you're bracing yourself for a fight. So every weekend, you're bracing yourself for what's coming. It may not be as bad, but all the emotions, all the cortisol that's running through your body to protect yourself from what could potentially be an argument or maybe not, who knows? But it may as well have happened every weekend because inside your body internally, you're doing it to yourself. Your anxiety's raising, your heart rate's going, your cortisol's flooding your brain with stress already. He would get to the point where he would just pick up a can. He'd have the first can. At that first can, he may as well have had 15 because I was reacting the same way as if he had already just had it. So every weekend was bad from that standpoint. There was no worse than another because every weekend I was doing it to myself, whether he did it or not. It was happening to me regardless because that stress is just there. So every weekend it may as well have been an issue.
Tell me about your feelings, because here's a young lady who wants nothing more than to be a mother and a wife. And all of a sudden, this vision that you had is not quite the vision that you wanted.
Yeah.
How are you feeling now?
Well, I'm not going to lie. There were times when I would be upset and I would sit and I would pray. I was very faith driven. And I would pray and I would say, why did you let me walk down the aisle? Why am I here? what is the point in this? We have these little children and I'm constantly battling this. He's not getting it. What? And I was looking up, why? What did you do? Mm. Why wasn't there a sign? Sometimes it just goes like that. Mm. Sometimes there is no sign. There's no rhyme or reason to why things are happening in your life. Like with the cancer, you couldn't predict that that was coming. I knew that I wanted to be a mum and a wife, but I didn't know what was around the corner. Just because you want something doesn't mean it's going to be rosy to get there. And sometimes the best things are the hardest to go through. Mm. There's a program in this country, you should watch it, it's really good. It's about two cousins that live on a council estate. Mm-hmm. And it's a BBC series.
Yeah.
It's really, really good. There's a point in it where Curtis turns to his cousin and he says, "You can't save a damsel in distress if she loves her distress." That sentence at that time really hit me, and that was me. I was a damsel in distress that was addicted to my own distress.
So, that's so interesting.
Yeah. So the mother and the wife goal was still there. I still love those bits because I had them five days a week, but 2 days a week, I was a damsel in distress that loved her distress.
Would you describe yourself as protecting Ross or being disappointed in him? At the weekends, I mean.
Yeah. I don't know. That's a really weird one to answer.
The reason I say protect is because when you said to me that he would not only apologise to you, but then he starts ringing round others. Mm-hmm. And as his wife, who's in love with him, are you trying to minimise that damage that he's created by making excuses to family and friends, or is it way beyond that?
I think I was hoping that the guilt of having to own up to your own behaviour, because I'm a person that if I feel guilty, I'm not doing it again. That guilt is enough to convict me to not do things. So I thought, if I can tell you what you've done, make you feel guilty enough about what you've done, and you have to apologise to everybody, that guilt will eat you up and you will change.
Yeah.
So I was doing what I felt
would work for you.
Would work for me. And in a way, it makes it worse because you can try any trick under the sun. You can try, you're not doing it intentionally. You're not. You're trying to find anything that works. So you'll try reasoning. You'll try guilt. You'll try understanding. I understand why you feel like this. Like, why are we doing this? Let's change these behaviours. You'll try anger. You'll try fight it back. You'll try gaslighting. Really? You'll try and put it back on them. You'll try anything you can to try and save yourself from having to keep going through what they're putting you through. And I unwittingly probably made the situation maybe worse sometimes, fighting fire with fire, combativeness, trying to stonewall him if he had done bad, like almost like, well, you're putting me through this. I'm not speaking to you. I'm just going to be quiet. And then they're just feeling like they're failing even more. So it's, you're unwittingly making it worse. Mm. I didn't know I was making it worse until now. Like as a 36-year-old woman coming out of it, I now look back at my own behaviour in those times and think, oh my God, I wasn't helping. I really wasn't helping.
What would you have done differently? That's interesting.
Yeah. I got asked this question actually not that long ago by our friends. So my friend turned to me at dinner and she said, if you had to go back and relive everything you'd done, would you relive it to get to where you are now? And there was a time in my life I would have said, absolutely not. There was a time in my life I thought, there is nothing you could say that would make me relive this. This is not worth it. Like, I love this person, but this is so hard. I would not do it again. Mm. I'd do it this one time, in this one life.
Yeah.
If I had to go back and have the choice, no way. Now, I honestly sat at that table and answered her, absolutely. I would go back and do everything exactly the same to ensure the outcome was like this. I would take it all again. I would do it all again.
Explain that to me.
I would do it again in a heartbeat. But the only thing I'd maybe do differently is go back and tell myself you can't save him.
Because you were trying to save him.
I was trying to save him.
All the time.
All the time. I was trying to save him. and save myself.
Because I wanted us. Yeah, 100%.
I wanted us. I wanted our children. And I knew he did too.
Yeah.
Because the version of him that is him is exactly on the same page. Works hard. Loves his family. Respects his wife. Like, he is the person who men strive to be. Mm. But the problem is that when you've got a people say illness, it's not an illness. I don't believe it's an illness. An illness is cancer. It happens to you without your choice. Mm. A choice that you're making is not an illness. It's just not. It's a weakness. There's a thing. Weak men create bad times. Bad times create strong men. Strong men create good times. But you have to kind of do this loop to get there. Mm. And some men need it more than others. Some men can learn vicariously through others. Mm-hmm. Some men have to do it themselves. Some men, no matter what you tell them, they're not going to listen anyway. Mm. So you just have to know in those moments, you can't save him.
Mm. You go on to have a third child. Mm-hmm. Is all this still going on when you have your third baby?
Yes. Rocco, yes. He is just the most sensitive little thing. He is just, he's so lovely. But it's tough because while this is going on, it sounds so bad to say you're raising these babies and still having these babies at the same time as all this. It sounds selfish to have these children while you're, well, you know what you're bringing them into. Like, you know that their dad's got this issue, because I knew bits. I didn't know the full extent for a while, but I knew enough to know that I was selfishly bringing these children into the world with somebody that was madly in love with, that was fighting demons.
Between Eli and Rocco, was there ever any respite? Did Ross ever stop? No, it was continuous.
Yeah,
was it getting worse?
Yeah, it got worse up until, I think, after Stoic. Stoic was probably about 2, and it started to come to a head around by the time Stoic was born. So Stoic is our 4th, and he is fierce. He is just a little ball of absolute energy, but he is all the good that's in Ross. That child is his exact double. It's creepy. They're so similar. They're so similar. And they're so, like, my older children, they say all the time, they laugh, and especially Noah and Eli, they like roll their eyes. And when Stoic does something, they just go, oh God, he's dad. Oh God, he's dad. Because he's so competitive and he's smart and he's just able. So if he says he's going to do something and he can do it, he'll do it. He'll outplank you by half an hour if he has to. He's done it. We've seen him. We had to actually stop our friends from putting bets on him because he kept holding it. We were like, okay, no, stop betting on him.
He's going to hurt himself.
He's going to hurt himself. Literally, he is just go, go, go. And he's all the good that is Ross. And the older two are like, here we go. But they love it.
Yeah.
But they really do. But it does sound bad when you're saying it, that dad's fighting these demons and you just keep having more babies. But Ross wasn't that person 5 days a week. Mm. I got who I'm married to now 5 days a week.
Yeah. And of course, you're still trying to save him.
I'm still trying to save him. I knew that there was a point when I probably couldn't. And I knew, like, so in Ross's podcast, he talks about that he was numb, is what he said. To get to numb, you got to go through everything. Mm. You don't get to numb quickly. Numb comes from years of emotional turmoil. Like the emotional roller coaster of being happy, sad, happy, sad. It pulls you in every direction. Numb is the end point. If somebody's numb and they're really not giving you anything back and they're just, do what you want. What can I do? I can't stop you. To get to that, that's a long time.
How long had it been now?
22, about 10 years.
10 years. And yeah. You've got 4 kids now?
4 children.
And it's still weekends only? Or is it creeping into the week?
It's creeping. It creeped into the week probably just towards the end. So towards probably around Stoic being born, last kind of 2 years, it got worse progressively. But yeah, still hiding it. Thinking he was hiding it and trying to stop. Like, but it was I think those last 2 years, it was just like it was harder, if anything, because he was trying to stop and then failing and then trying again. And he thought he could manage it.
Was it still going out, being one of the lads, or was it just big sessions at home?
It was a little bit of both, I think. Mostly just at home or around friends. Like, the going out thing had kind of stopped, like, years before that. It was tended to be more like either at home or at a friend's house, or like he'd go around to our friend, like our mates, and have some drinks with them and just wouldn't come home. You'd be like, oh God, here we go. But you become so numb to it because you have tried everything. You've given everything. So that numbness doesn't come quickly. It comes quite slowly.
And you're still protecting, and I'm sure protecting the children now. I was going to say protecting him, but you're protecting the children too.
We're trying.
What happens?
He came home and we had a big row. I can't even remember what it was about. I can't remember. But I was like, that's enough. I can't save you. I can't help you. You got to go. I was like, that is it.
Had he been sort of out all weekend? Is that, or was it just another
weekend? No, it was weekend, just another. I think it was just another. I just had enough. Yeah. And I think it was the having to do this again. You're going through this again. But now you're in your 30s. Mm. And you're tired. By the time you get to your 30s, you don't want these fights anymore. You just want peace. You want peace and to be who you're supposed to be all the time. Mm. Not changing. No, nobody changing. Just a stable personality. Just that's all you want.
Yeah.
So it got to the point where I said, you're going to have to go. I can't help you. I can't save you. You've got to do it now. I'm done. And I'd set up my own company in the year before because I kind of knew this was coming. So I knew something was building, that I was having enough. So I started doing night hair. So I started doing hairdressing at home.
Yeah.
And I would do, so I thought, how can I make a business that's different to anything else this town offers? We've got a lot of hairdressers where we live.
We have a lot. Yeah.
The competition is rife. So I thought, what can I do that makes me different to them? So I went full eco. So everything was eco-friendly, right down to bleach that you used. And I started doing it at night, not in the day. So women didn't have to get childcare. Mm-hmm. They could wait till their partners came home from work and then they could come out to me at 7 o'clock at night. And sometimes I wouldn't finish till 2 o'clock in the morning.
Oh my God.
So I would put our four children to bed while Ross was still working and they'd go to bed and I'd settle them all down. And then my client would turn up and I started this just from our dining room and they'd come and they'd sit 7 till 1, 2 o'clock in the morning, having their highlights done and everything at home. And then, and Ross would then come home from work and he'd be upstairs making sure that the boys stay in bed or like anything they needed, he took care of. And so I built this at the time, knowing, I think subconsciously, that something's coming to an end between me and Ross. Like something's coming to a head. There's either got to be a change, a big change, or I'm going to be alone. I thought, how on earth can I support these children myself as well? Like, not because Ross wouldn't ever have left me on my own. Like, he wouldn't have gone, oh no, I'm not looking after all our children. He would have paid.
He would have been there. Yeah.
He would have 100% been there. But I needed something that I could bring to the table for them. So I thought, I'll do night hair. And that grew and my client list grew. And then my parents let me have their outbuilding and I turned it into a salon. And so I started working from there and I'd have clients come, still same sort of thing, 2, 3 o'clock in the morning. And then I'd go home, which luckily for me was only over the road.
Yeah.
So I just had to just nip home. And that started to build. While that's all building over here, me and Ross are just doing this. And we're coming apart, like totally. And that was brutal. So when I told him to leave, I knew I had something I could lean on.
Because do you think that helped, that little bit of independence?
I think it
financial
helped.
Financial independence.
Yeah,
I
think it helped make the decision as a way of going, I know I'll be all right. I know I can do this. I know I'll be all right. So I had that backing in myself of going, I'll be fine. I got a good work ethic. I work hard. And I raised these children that are thriving and growing. They're doing okay. So I know I can do that. And I've juggled that and this now for about a year. So I can do this. And at that point, I was like, I don't deserve this. I don't deserve this. I deserve you at your best all the time. I deserve
that. Not part-time.
That. Yeah. Not part-time. Full-time. There, constantly. Not, who am I getting? What version of you am I going to get this weekend? Is it going to be this version? Ugh. That person could have got hit by a bus. I'd have been like, oh, no. Dear. Ross. Bus just hit Ross. Oh. Because you wouldn't even recognise him.
Yeah.
You'd be like, oh dear. Oh well. Oh, what a shame.
Did the kids see that version of Ross?
I think the older two did. Mm. I don't think you can shield them. Like, kids are way more intuitive than you give them credit for. Like, I think it would be so naive to think nothing that we're doing is affecting them, that you can row in front of your children and it doesn't affect them. It does. My parents rowed in front of me as a kid. I didn't cry myself to sleep about it. I knew that was just a part of life. So I think that then bled into, we can row and the kids are going to be okay because I'm okay. Like, the odd row here and there is fine, but the continual, here they go again.
Yeah.
Here they go again. You'd be naive to think that that doesn't affect your children. It does. It really does. And when they're 16, they tell you.
Really?
Yeah. So we've had some interesting conversations with Noah. After Ross came back, so Ross leaves, and that's it. A line has been drawn,
and he leaves because you're done.
Yeah,
it's not just a trial separation. Go and get clean. It's like,
no,
we're
no,
done.
I'm done. Yeah, yeah, by that end point, we'd had like a few bits before that. Mm. So I'd said like, that's it. You need to leave. You need to go get help. Relapsed on that because I'm in love. And okay, you're changed. Oh no, you're not. Oh wait, what's this? And then at that point, that very last point, that line had been fully, fully drawn. I was very, very, I was really under the impression he was not coming back. So when he left, although it's scary to do, by that point, you've done 10 years of this. Mm-hmm. You're so okay in yourself that you're going, no, I'm all right. I'm fine. And I genuinely thought that. I genuinely thought I'm okay. Like, this is a relief. I haven't got to deal with this anymore. I'll be fine. I didn't know what was coming after that, but I wasn't fine. I didn't realise what I was holding.
Yeah.
Until he came back after he got help and he was totally clean. He was like, that's it. It's no more.
How long was he gone for?
He was gone for a few months living at his parents and then he came back. But he was back every evening, like lots of conversations, like, oh my God, we talked about absolutely everything. It was quite nice sometimes. I was like, oh, I feel like we're just dating again.
Yeah.
It was quite nice. I actually quite enjoyed him coming back. It sounds weird, but I did. I got Ross at his absolute best every evening because we would go through absolutely everything. And we went through every memory, every upset, every hurt. We dug it all up. Like nothing was left unturned. We went through all of it. Every row. And it was nice. Sounds weird. It was nice.
And of course, if you're having these conversations when he's sober, they're going to be way more productive.
Way more productive. Mm. Way better.
Yeah.
That's so good. And so when he said, that's it, I'm not drinking anymore. I'm not going to touch it ever again. Of course, we had a few friends, family that were like, oh yeah, but what, like ever again? Like, surely you're like, let's just be for a while. Like maybe you could have one or two. So even after knowing everything, we still had people that couldn't really wrap their head around the, no, this is it. Like, this is a decision forever, but we're not lapsing on this. We're not going back. Like, that's the final straw. So when he said it and he was like, that's it, I'm done. I will never touch it again. I will never risk my family again. I can't believe I put you guys through all of this. I will not touch it. I apprehensively believed him. So I believed him, but it was, he's saying it with the same conviction. Our baby will be fine. We will be married no matter, like, we are going to, like, all the conviction right from young comes flooding back in that moment. So you've got Ross at the start who can tell you anything and convince you with just the passion in the way he's saying it. To Ross now, 10 years later, having gone through this whole ordeal, saying it with the same conviction. Mm-hmm. I will never touch it again. I promise. And at that point, I just said, okay, I believe you. I believed him. And I made the decision to do it with him. I said, I'm not. Yeah, there's no way. I was like, that took so much from us. I was convinced that alcohol was just the root of all evil.
Really?
Oh, yeah, 100%.
But yet you drank and were fine.
Yeah, but what it takes from people, it's like, let's say it never existed. Mm-hmm. It didn't exist to this day. There was no alcohol. There was no drugs. There was nothing. Like, we just had this world where everybody just drank water and water was fine. Then somebody comes along and they say, I've just made this concoction. If you drink it, you don't know what it's going to turn you into. It could turn you into somebody really fun, Tracy, or really, really chaotic. You could lose all your inhibitions. Maybe you'll cheat. Maybe you won't. Maybe you'll be aggressive. Maybe you won't. Maybe you'll be fun. But if you drink it, you could potentially lose everything you've ever built, everyone you love, your wife, your husband, your children. Are you going to drink it?
Well, no, if you put it like that.
Probably not. Because it's a dice. Mm. You're rolling that dice every single time. Because it's hard to know what it leads into. For some people, some people can just have one or two and they go to the end of their day and they say, I'll just have a glass of red wine. And that is a line drawn for them. They can stop there.
Yeah.
But you're rolling a dice. You don't know if that's you or not in a stressful situation. You put something under enough pressure. How's that going to affect you? Who's that going to turn you into? Mm. You just can't know when it's that intense and you're given, here, this will fix it. Mm. This will make you feel better. Try this. I was convinced. Absolute evil. I was like, no, it took way too much from me. I'm not touching it.
Well, it was a long time and it was 10 years.
So long.
So he comes back and then what?
So he comes back and we do the whole reconciliation thing and he slowly starts to build trust. So he did that in a really interesting way, actually, which made me feel very, very uncomfortable when he was doing it. But actually, it was probably a good thing. Every time he felt like he was going to relapse, he would call me and he would tell me. So I'd be driving along. Ah, my bubble's nice. Ross is back. Everything's happy. And then I'd get a phone call and he'd be like, oh, I'm thinking about having a drink. I'm just letting you know. I'm thinking about doing this. I'm just letting you know. It's in my head. I need to get it out of my head. He's like, and if I tell you, it's gone out of my head. And I'd be like, okay, thank you for telling me. Wow. That feels really nice to know. Thank you for telling me. So I'd have to thank him for his honesty through gritted teeth because at that time I'd be like, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God.
It's happening again.
Please don't give in. Please don't give in. Stay strong. So I'd be supportive on the phone with sheer panic. Mm. And I'd be driving like, oh God, please, no, no. But if he's calling me, he's holding himself accountable at that time. So he started to build trust like that. And I knew that if any time he thought about it, I was going to know because he was going to tell me. And then it was just a case of waiting it out. And time would reveal all. And he never touched it. And then I started to have panic attacks really badly. I didn't know where they came from. And looking into it now, it's just a huge PTSD moment. So it did not hit me until after, when he had turned into somebody that I felt I could be vulnerable with, that's when it came crumbling down for me. And I let all my walls down. But walls coming down, what people don't tell you is they say, oh, you have to let your guard down. Let your guard down and be honest. That's not easy to do. That's a nightmare. And it hurts. Like, walls coming down are painful. Like, when you knock a building down or you knock a wall down, you gotta smash it. It's not easy to do. It really, really hurts. So the panic attacks would set in randomly for no reason. And it would just be uncontrollable crying. And it would all just come flooding out.
Just from nowhere. Just, yeah.
Yeah. And I'd be like, I didn't understand it because I thought I'd processed everything like while it was happening, but you're not processing it. All you're doing is you're building a shield. Mm. You're putting armor on every single time. You're adding a little bit more armor, a little bit more armor. You're not going to hurt me. A little bit more armor. Mm. And then when you've got to start taking that armor off, because otherwise you can't be that person. That person that you created to withstand war can't be taken into your future. You're not that person anymore. The person you created to go through what they went through, you can't carry that person on into a new life. You almost have to let that version of yourself die and go, okay, this version's not me anymore. And I've got to start being vulnerable. I got to start telling him the truth of what I really feel.
Talk to me about that.
No, it's not easy. It's not easy to do. It's not easy. I'm now a master at, like, if you have a panic attack, I now know exactly how to stop one. Just come speak to me. It lasted about a year. They lasted about a good year.
That must have been so scary because they're like having a heart attack.
It's exhausting.
You think you're going to die.
Yeah, it's exhausting because, first of all, you can't catch your breath. So your breathing starts to go. And you feel it, you know it's coming. It starts like a wave. If you've never had one, you're like you just said, Tracy, it's like you feel like you're going to die. It feels like you're going to have a heart attack because it starts in your chest and in your stomach and everything just feels like it's kind of pressing. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden you're gasping for air and then you're crying and then you're on the floor and you're like, oh, and how did we end up here? And then you have to do little tricks like box breathing. So that's where you breathe in for four, out for four, in for four, out for four. And you have to just ground yourself and let yourself know that you're good. Nothing's going to touch you. Nothing's coming for you. You're fine because it's just your nervous system sending you into absolute frenzy. But once you can control your nervous system and realize you're all right, you're okay, you can then deal with it. But there was nights that they'd come in the middle of the night and he would just, all he could do was hold me and be like, I'm here, I'm not going anywhere. You just have to repeat the same thing. Mm. I'm not going anywhere. I'm not drinking. I'm not doing this. I'm good. We're good. And it's just a constant flow of affirmation that you need at that point. But when you're in it, you feel like you're drowning. But it was good in a way because he was the one that had to hold me up. Mm. So it meant that he got to put right what he'd done wrong.
Be responsible.
Yeah. And at that point, when you're leaning on somebody that heavily after everything they've put you through, because he chose to do that. Yes, at that point, it is the addiction, but it's still a choice, especially as a German, you're going, no, they choose. That's your choice. You chose to do that. We're very like pragmatic. We know certain steps you have to take. And if you're getting to the point where you're going, I'm going to choose this over you, then you made that choice.
Yeah.
That's not an illness. You chose that. So I know that he did that, choosing that. And then to be vulnerable and cry and be like, why did you do that? Why did you do that? And then every single time he got to tell me why. Every single time he's got to apologize. Every single time he's got to comfort me and make me better. Like, he gets to prove each time why. He gets to prove each time that he's not going to go back and do it again. And that just made us, I think, even stronger, even though you feel weak at the time. You don't realize it's building strength until afterwards when you're like, oh, actually, you're now comforting me. You're fixing me. I'm not fixing you anymore. You're fixing what you did in me. You did this and you're now taking responsibility and you're putting it back together.
Talk to me, because all that's come about because of the emotional load you're carrying when it's bad. Talk to me about that emotional load that maybe people on the outside don't see. Those people that said to Ross, what, forever? Clearly didn't see that emotional load.
I don't think they saw the true severity of it. There were a few people that knew, like inner circle knew. They were not the ones that were like, what, forever?
Yeah.
Like my mum, she was actually the first one that said, Becky, you know this is a you too problem. She was like, if he stops drinking, you have to stop drinking. And at first my reaction was, why? Why do I have to stop? This is not my issue. I don't have an issue. I was like, but she was very, very firm. And she was like, when you're married and you're together, your problems really are each other's problems. Mm. If he's got a problem, you got the same problem. It's going to manifest in a different way, but it's your problem. And I was like, all right, okay. So I have women like my mum, like my grandma, my sisters that will hold you accountable. But what happens when you're carrying that much emotional load? You stop telling them. So like when Ross was saying in his podcast, you just have to talk and tell your family what's going on, you start to know what you should do. So I knew I should have left. I knew I should have. I knew what advice I would give myself. Mm-hmm. And it was, you can't help him, you have to leave. I didn't want to hear that. So every time it came in, my fingers would go in my ears and I'd be like, no, I don't have to. I'll just carry on. So what you do is you start to hide that emotional load and you become almost like a functioning... the word I'm looking for. So addicts will be functioning addicts. You could work with somebody that's addicted to cocaine and you'd never know, because they're just going to do it at home and then they're going to go into work. You could be working with somebody that's addicted to all sorts of things, anything, porn, anything. People will hide what they're doing and still go to work. It is the same when you're carrying that weight. Like I could literally have a conversation with anybody at the time and nobody would have known what I was thinking, feeling, going through, because I'd have done this. Hi.
Yeah.
Oh, what's wrong with you? How are you? You tell me what's wrong with you. So I don't talk about me because I know that if I do, you're only going to give me the advice I would give myself, which is leave, which I'm not going to do. I don't want to hear it. So I'm not going to do it. So I'm not going to tell you. So at that point, what's the point? What's the point in telling your mum that you had her out again? What's the point in crying on your grandma again? There's no point, because you're only doing the same thing you've always done, which is moan and then carry on. Moan and carry on. But you have to, once you make that decision not to do that for yourself and you do go, right, I'm drawing that line, then you can tell people the full extent. At that point, you've pretty much already dealt with it yourself, because it's only you that can save you. They can only save themselves, because you can't save them. And only you can save yourself from what you're going through, which sounds awful, but it is the truth. Women, we know women that are going through all sorts of things in life, and they can only save themselves. Nobody's coming to save you. That reality is hard to hear, but it's the truth. You're responsible for your own future, your children's future. You're responsible for anything you put into your body that may affect how your household runs. Only you can save you.
And do you think you've reached that point where you've said to Ross, you're leaving, knowing that you've now got 4 children on your own, that's because you'd reached that moment that actually only I can save me?
Yeah, it was that. It's like, you know, in a movie when it goes and it like warps out and then the hero is kind of standing there like, what the hell? One of those moments. There's a thing that Jordan B. Peterson says in one of his podcasts, and it's everybody, every single one of us on this planet is running a story, is running their own story. And there's a narrative to every single person's life, and we are all playing a character in these stories. What character are you playing? if I look back and I look at what character that girl was playing, the damsel who loved her distress, victim mindset, why is this happening to me? I don't deserve this. I'm staying strong for my children, sure, but I don't deserve this, but I'm going to still do it anyway. Damsel that loves the distress. If I look at my life now, I feel like the hero's journey that is Ross's, because it's very much a hero's journey, like you said at the start, these sides are seldom spoke about. Mm-hmm. Ross's side is more glorified, mm-hmm. because everybody loves the success story. Mm-hmm. Everybody wants to know, I can do it too. If he can do it, I can do it. So then they're empowering. It's a really cool story to become the hero in your own narrative. When you've gone through it on the flip side, you don't feel like that. You feel like you're not going through these trials. These trials are being done to you. You can feel bitter. You can feel resentful. You can feel all these emotions that are just so negative that you get stuck in this victim mindset. And the way to pull yourself out is by going, actually, no, I'm the heroine of this story and I will change my own narrative. But I think everybody has to look at themselves and ask what character they're playing. Like, you're a different version in each chapter of your own story, but ultimately, who do you want to be? And I know that Ross wants to be the hero, and I want to be right there by his side. And that gets you through all of it.
Looking back, I know when I spoke to Ross, he said that it was really hard for him to open up and accept ultimately what was shame, you know, and to actually sit there and process that. When you look back as a mother more so, do you feel that because maybe you stayed too long, or do you think that there's no reason for you to feel shame? I ask the question because of other women that may be watching this. I don't want them to then sit there and go, oh my God, I should be doing something about this. I don't want them to feel guilt because you're in a situation. But looking back now, do you feel that? Any of that guilt, shame that you didn't leave earlier, or?
No. And I'll explain why. I don't feel any shame attached to how long I stayed, even though we went what we called at the time damage control with the boys. So when Ross came back, we were, for the first year, we were very aware that we were on damage control because of how we'd behaved in that time, like the arguments and things. Mm-hmm. So we were very much like, we need to make sure that they feel safe. Mm-hmm. And it all went on all became about them. I think if I attach shame to how long I'd stayed, I don't think I'd get out of bed. Mm. I think if you have to release shame to be able to move forward, if you feel shame because of how long you're in your situation for, you've got to let that go. Mm. Because if you are letting that consume you to the point where you're feeling nothing else, guilt, shame, depression, it all just feeds into this beast that wants to keep you in bed, not moving forward, not doing things, not seizing, not changing your circumstance for yourself or for your children or for anything else. Shouldn't feel shame. Shame is such a useless emotion because it does nothing but batter your own sense of self. Once you release that and you think, actually, no, I don't need to feel like this, let it go, because it really isn't doing you any good. And if you need to do that with help or with meditation, it is massive. Meditation is hugely helpful. Meditate and you can go through all of it with yourself and get an answer. If you sit there for long enough and think, what am I doing that's making this worse? Because it sounds bad, but you probably are doing something that makes it worse. I didn't know it at the time. I was, like I said earlier, stonewalling, probably gaslighting, probably doing all sorts of manipulative behavior that I wasn't aware of to try and get him to stop being hit, like who he was on the weekends. Yeah. So, but you try everything without realizing it. But it's turning you into somebody that's not you. So you have to let that person go. And the shame that's attached to that person is not helpful. Let her go. Let him go. And have a look into yourself and see what boundaries you want to set and go, actually, no, I don't deserve this.
It's fair to say that the person abusing the alcohol is changing, you know, when they're under the influence. And, mm-hmm. and you've said a few times that the version of Ross you would get on a Friday and Saturday was mm-hmm. not the version of Ross that you had Monday through to Thursday. But equally, the version of the partner changes to cope with that. And it's really interesting when Ross then got clean mm-hmm. that you then recognised, which I think is amazing, by the way, that you then recognise, actually, I have to also let her die and move on and be somebody else. Mm. And what would you say then to women out there that perhaps don't realise they are a different version of themselves because they are still protecting, trying to change, trying to fix, in the brace position, hoping it will all be okay for the family, and don't recognise that actually I've got to do something because I can't save them? What would you say to them?
I think meditation, I'm going to say again, meditation really helped open my eyes to a lot of like a higher sense of self. And I think once you reach that higher sense of self by learning more about yourself, you recognize what you're doing, if it's helpful or if it's not helpful, if it's you, if it's not you. I think ultimately everybody knows. I think at the time you don't realize that you're making these decisions based off out of fear, but it's all out of fear. You're scared. You're scared of what's coming, you're scared of what you're bracing for, you're scared of what may fail, you're scared of your future, you're just scared. Mm. It's fear driven. So I think the only thing that you can do is to try and let go of that fear. Back then, there was nothing available. I didn't have internet. You had to pay for internet on your phone still. So we didn't have internet at our fingertips. We were not armed with the same level of words and understanding that we're armed with now. And the amount of accounts out there with free advice like yours, like so many others, that you can actually learn how to release those things. Try and find those pages that help. Like advice that you can be given in those moments that are hard, and learn and absorb as much as you can. Because the moment you start learning and absorbing more, podcasts are fantastic. Mm. I'm so grateful for being invited to yours, Tracy, because they really, truly were the only thing I had at one point. Because,
really?
Yeah, a lot of the help stuff that you see online, a lot of it's advertised. You'll see it pop up on your social media pages as ads. You got to pay for it. Back then, I had no money. So if I needed to pay for something, I wouldn't have been able to afford it, even if I wanted to. Like, yeah. I wasn't going to go pay for therapy. It was expensive. Like, but there's so many free things out there now that can help you. And podcasts, I just absorbed so much knowledge from so many different podcasts that I learned a lot about myself. Learning about yourself will help you relinquish that fear. And that fear is what is ultimately driving your behavior. You will then change it naturally. You won't have to try. It just will. Mm-hmm. It will happen. You'll go, right, okay, I'm learning more about why I do this, why I'm like this, why do I... You can type it in. You can go on your Spotify and type in, why do I blow up every time my boyfriend comes home with bad news? Or something like, do you know what I mean? I'm plucking something out of my brain.
Yeah.
But you can type that into your search bar. You'll get loads of podcasts that come up with that type of thing. Mm. Find one that works and learn about yourself. Let go of that fear, and that fear will help you realise, actually, I'm not being the best version I can be of myself, and hold yourself accountable. I think a lot of women fail to do that when they're in those situations because it all attaches to what's happening to them. Well, it's not me, it's him. He's doing this, he's the problem. He's bringing all these issues to me. So how can I be the bad one? Oh, you can be the bad one. So you could not be helping the situation. You could be unwillingly making it worse. But not even realizing you're doing it. You're trying all these different things, but actually you're being gaslighty, being a bit narcissistic, maybe a little bit self-centered, like all these little things that you don't realize you're being at the time is only to protect yourself because you're scared. So I think letting go of that fear helps.
You're so right about the fear, because a lot of times I get women that will come to me, not obviously for counselling, but they want to know, because if they have been the main carer of the children, they want to know, well, what am I entitled to? Like, if I pull the plug on this and I ask him to go, or I go with the children, where does that leave me? I'm not the breadwinner.
Yeah.
So what am I entitled to,
so
Trace?
That's scary.
That is scary.
Yeah, it's
you know,
so
if
scary.
You have thrown yourself into a situation where you are the mother and the wife and the carer and all those things, it makes you really vulnerable financially.
Oh, absolutely.
And that I think adds to the fear, as well as who's coming home this evening.
Yeah.
Which version of him am I getting this evening? Will he even come home this evening? So the fact that you've hit upon that fear, I think, is so important, because that's, I think, what keeps a lot of women trapped. The other thing I wanted to talk to you about is, I hear a lot, I'll stay until the children are older. What would be, for you, it all worked out and you've got the perfect happy ending. But for someone that's been through it, what would you say to somebody that says, well, when the kids are older, I'll leave then? Would you have advice for them?
I think that one's a little bit tough. Everybody's situation is so different. I think if you're going to stay together for the children, I don't want to shine a light on it being necessarily a bad thing. Sometimes it can be a bad thing, and sometimes it can be a good thing. It's all circumstantial. But I think what you have to be aware of is, maybe if you are staying together for the children, make sure your children aren't shutting down and they're not being quiet and they're still talking to you about a lot of things. You'll recognize a happy child. A happy child is going to speak to you. It's going to run in. It's going to tell you everything it did that day. If you've got a kid that's coming home and the second mum or dad start having discussions or whatever, they shut their bedroom door and they're hiding, or they're not talking to you, they're shutting down. I think those are the little things you need to maybe analyze and go, is this actually best? Are we making the best decision here to stay together for them when actually it's doing this to them? And really, ultimately, how much do we love each other? Because that's all it comes down to. It's not, you can stay together for children or break up because you feel like you're damaging children, but at the real core of it is, how much do you really love who you're with? Because the children are resilient, and we know, like, two of ours got put through those 10 years. Two of them have been raised without it, without any real knowledge of it, and it's not affected them. The older two would absolutely stand there and say, we're so glad you didn't give up. We're so glad you fought through it. We're so, so glad. That you just need to be accountable and make sure you have those conversations with them. Like, we have these awkward conversations with ours sometimes about the past and what, if anything, comes up for them. And we make sure that they talk about it. We're very, very open about it. Nobody's pretending it didn't happen. Mm-hmm. It happened. It was part of your story. But let's talk about it, and now we'll analyze it together and we'll move forward together. And that's what we're going to do. So they would turn around, those older two, and say, we're glad you fought it out. We're glad that you stayed for us. So it's all really circumstantial, but at the core of it, me and Ross really loved each other. And I think you just got to make sure do you really love each other? Like, that's what you need to work out. Is this working? I think once you add the children guilt on, it's only going to make the decision more cloudy. Really, the only question you need to answer is, do you love me? Do you love me enough to sacrifice what you want for me and the children? Do I love you enough to sacrifice what I want for you and the children? And it all just comes down to those two people, how much they really love each other. And I think that would probably be my only takeaway.
That's such a good answer. I asked the question because there will be women out there that are just too afraid to go, because they'll think, how is this going to impact on the children?
Of course.
Final question just on that. When you did ask Ross to go, how were the kids?
Yeah, they were the little two. Stoic was two. Rocco was six. So those two didn't really know much. The older two were a little bit more guarded. They were like, oh, is he not coming back? Why is he not coming back? Like asking just a lot of questions. But like I said earlier, children, the resilience in children, they can cope with so much more than you give them credit for. We think that they're these little things that we need to protect. And we do. You have to protect them from danger, and you have to feed them and make sure they have enough water in the day. But you emotionally, they are way, way, way more resilient than we give them credit for. And they can understand a lot more. And they're willing to take on a lot more than we let them. I think when you let them into a bit more of an adult world with the right language, they can handle it. They can understand, Daddy has to go get help for him. Daddy's going to be better for us. So he's got to leave and he's got to go get help. All right, he's going to go get help. Okay. And they're like, can we go get my cars now?
Yeah.
Just like, all right. And it wasn't too bad.
Whew.
Yeah. So, but we build it up, I think, in our heads that
it's
going to be this big thing and we're going to damage them forever. And oh no, they're going to be traumatized their entire lives. They're not. Like, they may get moments that throw up that you think, right, okay. And now here we are, damage control. Let's talk about it. What is coming up for you? Let's put a narrative in place that actually, okay, you're feeling like it went like this. The reality of it is it went like this. How do we make sure that you don't carry this into your future? They can deal with it.
Absolutely.
They really can.
Awareness. Well, I mean, what you're talking about ultimately is the awareness.
100%. They're aware. As long as you're aware of kind of what you're saying to them and you're not going, your dad's a shit. Your dad's useless. I think the second you start parent bashing does not help.
That
I would not advise. But I think when you're ultimately looking at it going, dad's got to get help. Dad's got a problem. Mum's got to get help. Mum's got a problem. And they're just going, all right, okay. So when we've got a problem, we get help. Cool. They get it.
Yeah.
I don't think that's a bad thing.
So what's life look like now? You're still exhausted because you're working so hard.
Oh, gosh, yeah, we work so hard, honestly. Ross works ridiculously hard, and I'm so proud of everything that he's built and we're building together. We work together, so for me, happiness is definitely picking up the boys from the school run every day together. I love that. That's part of our day. Mm. We had one of our staff say to us the other day, oh, is Ross going on the school run, is he? I was like, yes, actually, we missed a lot of school runs together, like when we were younger. So we're not missing anymore.
Yeah.
We prioritise the little things. Ice bathing with the boys in the morning and working with Ross every day.
Are you still working at it? Just you independently?
I mean, I meditate every day. I ice bath every day. So if that's working at it, then maybe. But I think it's probably just sustaining it.
Yeah.
Making sure that those practices we've put in place now don't diminish. The ice bath really, 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 really helped. Meditation and communication.
Having a focus. I mean, Ross ended when he did the podcast with me, saying that he has a focus. Every day he will get up and he will have a purpose for that day.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's really key. Mm-hmm. And given that you've joined him on the sobriety journey, you also have your purpose.
Yeah.
I never lost your purpose.
I don't, for me, it's not like it sounds funny to say, I don't need a purpose. I'm still ultimately a wife and a mother above anything else, above work, above the business, above anything else. I am a wife first and then a mother. And then my life is secondary to that, but anything that I can do that sustains that life and that day, ice bath and all those things, I do it. I'll do it.
Becky, thank you.
Thank you.